Hello and welcome to Gribbing in the Filth with me, Tom Sharp. Today it's off into the dark and waterlogged green, into a world which presumably, from a certain perspective, has as much majesty as any woodland or jungle, though perhaps it's a place we might more reasonably compare to some vast kelp forest. I'm not sure, I've not been there. But what would it be like, I wonder, to be there, in the moss, trying to avoid the grinding jaws and the deadly currents conjured up by its predators? All that drama, lives and deaths, unfolding a thousand times in little fuzzy patches of green, spattered on roof tiles and brickwork. Ages pass, with things lying dormant then rising, with the coming of rain, predating, surviving, breeding. All this in the fuzz that has grown on the roof of a butcher's or an adult cinema. The mundane is not. Within the unconsidered, there is secret spectacle. Animal lives are imperceptible to the naked eye. Luckily, I know a man with a microscope and a penchant for the little lads living within the bryophyte forests that surreptitiously busy our world. Today we're going to learn what it is that's living in the moss. Join me for a moss safari with Andrew Chandler-Grevitt. Hello Andrew, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Very pleased to be here.
I'm very pleased to have you. And you are, you run Moss Safari, you are the curator of Moss Safari, you are the facilitator of Moss Safaris. How would you, what's your wording?
That's a very good question. I do them, it's an activity, and I sort of spread onto social media with it. And so I sort of brought it together in its current format, I suppose, and people, it's captured people's imagination, so more people are doing them. So yeah, I'm a sort of, I don't know whether founder is the right word, but the sort of the gem of Moss Safari, the idea of that has sort of been proliferating, if that's the right word.
I'm sure that it is. And beyond that, what's been your relationship with invertebrate animals, kind of professionally and personally in your life?
Ah, throughout my entire life, one of my earliest memories is with woodlice. So okay. Woodlice have been a big part of my life since I was a tiny lad, sort of 3 or 4. I used to collect them up in the garden in a little pot, and I was very aware very early on that they carried their babies underneath, much to my mum's astonishment. So I've always had a fascination with nature. I always see nature and see invertebrates around, and vertebrates as well. You know, I'm not
sure.
I'm not choosy, but obviously today is all about the invertebrates, which I'm very happy to focus on. So woodlice have always been an absolute fascination for me. In terms of the moss safari, is open the world through looking through a microscope, which I've always had a microscope since I was a boy as well. So this, and it sort of revisited this in, when I'm much older. I'm just approaching 50 now. So, you know, it's been a half a century of fascination in these things, and just learning, so much learning all the time. And that's the thing I find really fascinating.
Well, learning is an interesting thing to mention, because as well as there's this nice new phrase at the moment, which is lifelong learners, which is bandied around educational communities and things like that. But your Moss Safari work is a sideline, or it's connected to your broader educational work, right? So you are
absolutely
someone who is invested in and takes part in the educational world. So is Moss Safari, did you come to that as someone wanting to use it as an educational tool? Or is this something that you were interested in that you wanted to be able to share? Or kind of how does it connect to your educational?
So my main job is training teachers. I was a secondary school science teacher for a number of years, and then I got into teacher training. I did a doctorate in science education. My early degrees are in science, biology particularly. That sort of starts from that, but this sort of natural interest in the natural world. And then I had the opportunity to use a microscope at home again, just before the lockdowns, actually. And so I was using a microscope at home, and it was a colleague of mine who sadly passed away, and he was an awesome colleague.
Sorry to hear that.
Jonathan Bacon, he introduced me to the life in moss. And so I started to look at that, and then I showed my trainees, and then I realized there was a barrier pedagogically, because a lot of them didn't feel that they could do it in class because they didn't know enough about what they were looking at. So there was this sort of barrier. And to me, that didn't matter. It was the discovery that was important for me, the moment of looking at your first drop of water, that moment of seeing life on a different level, that moment of just asking all those questions. Well, what is that? How does it move? Why is it doing that? All those things, for me, are very good pedagogic things. You know, we're getting to a point where children are thinking, asking questions. So from there, I started to think, well, how can you make this accessible? How can you give a teacher confidence to go in and do this with a class of children, give them experience of their first drop of water from Moss, and still feel confident about being able to answer some questions? And that's where Moss Safari came up. I went for the big five, like you would on an African safari or similar, where you have the big five animals you're looking for. And then you've got the things on the periphery, which you might come by. But the idea is you go in looking for the big five, and that really helps focus the process.
What's really interesting, I think, about the notion of a Moss Safari is that, you know, within that phrase Moss Safari, there's this obvious kind of strangeness in the sense that moss, we tend to think of moss as a thing that covers a thing which in itself is part of an environment, as opposed to being an environment in and of itself. So absolutely. I don't think it's something that is, you know, like so many things, when you start talking about the invertebrate world, or you start to talk about the natural world that exists at a scale that isn't immediately relatable to us, you have to kind of make these leaps in your mind to realize, oh, moss, this thing that I thought of as a kind of felty plant, not entirely even sure what it is, maybe, is in itself a world, you know, and to life forms, as alive as we are, this is their whole world. Is there much going on in the moss then?
There is. And I mean, this is the thing that the feedback I get is usually people say, I would never look at moss the same way again. And to be honest, I'm not looking at moss and say, I see moss everywhere now. It's one of those things on television programs where there's they're running through a forest. I'm homing in on the moss that's in there. Even if it's a very important part of the storyline, that you just sort of, I'm seeing it everywhere. But it is really odd. So I work on my roof moss. My moss have moss on my roof, and right, it gets knocked down, and I get these little cushions down on my patio, and I pick them up, and those are the ones I usually look at. I do collect moss from other places, but my main interest is what lives on my roof, really. And it is another world, and it's an ecosystem on its own, and it's part of the larger ecosystem. And if you think about moss, it's been around for a very long time. It's one of the earliest plants. It was the first type of plant to sort of come out of the water and set some sort of roots onto land. It's very important in the succession cycle, in establishing soil and stuff on bare rock and so on. People see it as a primitive plant, which it is in the fact that it was a very early plant, but it's had so much time to evolve. There's amazing things that go on in the plant itself, and how it reproduces and how it interacts with the organisms that live within it. There is an awful lot going on. And the thing that amazes me most is the movement in moss. When moss is sodden, when it's wet, and all the animals, a lot of the organisms there cause currents. They make currents to catch their food. They sit where they are, cause currents, bring the food to them. And the amount of currents and movement that's going on in there, I find quite incredible, because you just don't see it from outside. It's not until you get it under the microscope that you see all those currents, all that movement, all the things that are going on. So there is an awful lot going on. And walking past moss now, I often, my initial thoughts are often, what type of moss is that? Because I'm not so good at that. But also, I wonder what's living in there.
There's been a great deal of teasing about these things that live in the moss. We'll unleash that upon everyone in a moment. But I think it's important, because you've mentioned a few times water, and you've mentioned a drop of water from the moss. But moss is not something that I see as an aquatic plant. Would it be fair to describe moss as an aquatic habitat?
Yeah, this is an interesting question, because I describe it more often as an extreme microhabitat, and part of that is being aquatic at times. So I think it is very extreme, and all the organisms that live in it, permanently live in it, are are extremophiles. They have to cope with extremely wet periods, but also extremely dry, drying out completely. They also have to deal with, if you think of the moss on my roof. Now, I live in South England, but, you know, we will have frosts and snow sometimes of the year, and other times of the year on the roof, it could get up to in the 30s. So there's extreme temperature differences as well. There's periods where there is no water in there. There's periods when it is absolutely sodden. At the moment, it's beautifully sodden, so I can just pick moss up, and there's a world going on in there. So they have to be able to survive those periods, either by leaving the moss or coming back. But when you say about an aquatic environment, I think an important part to realise is that moss is part of the water film that goes across everything, really. So whenever there's moisture, whenever there's rain, we've got a film over everything, like water film, and microorganisms are moving in that film, and also the multicellular organisms, whether they're in a dormant state, or whether it's their eggs, or whether it's another, or whether it's them themselves, are moving within that water film. And so they move from the roof, for example, down the water pipes, and they're going to drains, or they might just go onto the patio and or onto the soil. So they're moving between environments all the time as well, and getting caught on bird legs and you know, or feathers and stuff like that, and they get moved around in that way. So they are part of a water film. So yes, if there was no water, there would be no organisms. So they are part of the aquatic environment for that. A very long answer. Yes, I suppose it is an aquatic environment, but it's like those pools that dry up. You need to, and those puddles. Right, it's temporary. It's not permanent.
So these animals that live within that environment are able to move through. Let's dive into this big five. And let's say that you get a droplet of water. And I don't know how often this would happen, but...
Well, I've got one in front of me now, just so you know, because I know this is not, you know, you can't see what I'm doing, but I have a microscope set up on my desk permanently, and whenever I'm bored, I will squeeze some moss look.
This is such a fantastic twist. I wasn't expecting this. Okay, right. Please tell me what's in your moss.
So I went and got some this morning. This is my second squeeze. First squeeze was a little bit disappointing, but my second squeeze has been very exciting. So when I talk about squeeze, what I've done is I've agitated the moss a bit with a pair of tweezers just to knock the animals off the stems and stuff. And then I put it through a filter. And so I get a nice little concentrate in the corner of the filter. And then I just get a pipette and put two drops onto a microscope slide, and now I'm looking at the organisms in there. So at the moment, I can see a leaf. Now, everything I'm seeing is less than 1 millimeter. So right. I think that's the important thing to realize. Everything I see in this field of view, it's times 40, is less than a millimeter. And the first thing I've got here is a very wiggly nematode. Okay, so there's a nematode here, and she's transparent. They come in male and female. I don't know whether that's a male or female. You can tell by the end of their tail, but I can't. It's too wiggly, so I can't tell. But what I can see is that there's a lot of things inside it. So the transparency is an amazing thing. They've got a head end and a tail end. They contain a digestive system and a nervous system and a very rudimentary circulatory system as well. So straight away, I'm seeing an awful lot going on there. And if she was still, I'm calling her she, I've obviously just decided she's a she. Her mouth parts, you can tell by their mouth parts what they eat. So they might eat bacteria. They might actually eat the moss itself by putting a little sort of needle-like thing into the moss cells. She's just gone out of view, actually. She's just wiggled off. The thing about nematodes, so this is just an example of the first one out of the big five. So this is a multicellular organism, obviously. But the thing that fascinates me about this is that they are everywhere in our soil and in the sea and in our fresh water and everything. In terms of biomass on the planet, there's more biomass of nematodes than there are wild animals and wild birds. So that sort of thing blows my mind. Okay, so when we're talking about biomass, we're talking about the amount of carbon stored in these organisms. So and in fact humans are only just above that, so only a small amount above that in terms of biomass. So they're incredible creatures. The other thing I look at is adaptations and why these are so well adapted. So these will turn into a sort of, they curl up into a ball when they start to feel environmental stress. they will go into a state of stasis where they will, when things dry up, they move down to the bottom of the moss and they'll weather extreme conditions of dryness. They often will just lay eggs rather than actually tolerate extreme drought. But some are adapted to. They have a sticky bit at the end of their tail, which helps them latch on and then wiggle around and catch passing things to eat. And the other sort of big thing is that they are species of nematode are model organisms, and they've won, I think it's 3 Nobel Prizes based on research done on them, including aging, research into aging, into degenerative diseases and things like that. So we learn a lot from these organisms themselves. So that's just one, that's just the nematode straight away.
If you're enjoying Grubbing in the Filth, come and wallow with me in the horrendous world of social media. You can follow Grubbing in the Filth on Instagram and Twitter. On Instagram, it's at Grubbing in the Filth, and on Twitter, it's at GITF Podcast. You can also email grubbinginthefilth@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, whether it's your own perspective, to share a story, a photo, or what have you.
I can move on slightly, and I have got, which is the most sought after, is a tardigrade. People
oh,
want
go.
To see tardigrades, okay? So have you seen a tardigrade in real life? Have you,
yeah. Well, there's a big question. Almost certainly yeah. they've been within my field of vision, but not in a way that I
yes.
can... So I guarantee I've been near them. I guarantee
yes.
that I've been around them. Tardigrades are one of those animals that in the last kind of, I don't know, 10 years, they've kind of... They developed a reputation, right, yeah. online, and they become quite a joked about and talked about animal because of their extremophiles and because of, you know, they're quite appealing to the eye and a water bear, right? Or a moss pig.
Yeah, absolutely. So they are, I mean, they have caught people's imaginations, and rightly so, because they're so... right, I mean, if we start just when we see one, what you'll usually see is some movement within the debris that you've got on the slide. And I've got... there's 2 main types. There's sort of a soft... one, and there's an armoured one. There's lots of species within that, of course, and we're finding them all the time. Just a couple of, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, they found a new species in a Japanese car park. You know, you just find these fascinating new ones all the time. So they're always finding new things and new things about how they survive. So they are extremophiles, and they do something really incredible. They turn into a ton, and that ton is basically, they shrink back from their bodies. They've got a cuticle. They exclude as much water, probably all the water, from them. But then when they rehydrate, they're able to reanimate and become alive again, whether or not they're dead in that. I'm very interested. They're on the verge of life and death. They're nice. That moment they can, you know, at what point are the cells not functioning? But how is it that they're able to come back to life? And they've got, if I'm talking to A-level students, I can talk about the proteins and stuff involved with that. And but we still don't know a lot. We're still trying to find out. But they can, because they're extremophiles, we want to see, being humans, we want to see how extreme they are. So we've bombarded them with radiation. We shoot them out of guns. We take them up on the International Space Station and do experiments with them. There's an Israeli spacecraft probe went up to the moon with them and crashed. And so there are ton state tardigrades on the moon at the moment. So, you know, if ever we get a wash of water, they might be the first organisms to actually colonize the moon. So I don't know what the food chain would be like. I think they'd have to, but absolutely. But they are fascinating. But the thing is, they are so adorable, and there's something really, so they move slowly like they are moonwalking. I often think it. So their name tardigrade means slow walker, and they've got 8 nice. Legs. 8 stubby legs with claws on the end. So these large claws. They've got a sort of teddy bearish thing. Their face is a snout. So they've got this little piglet snout, and their snout yes. is the mouth part. And often you can see 2 red, which are eyes. They're light sensitive cells, just single cells. They're only made of 1,000 cells, but we have actually now managed to map all their cells. We've mapped their nervous system as well as their genome as well. So we're when I say we, I'm talking about scientists. I have had no involvement. I've just read about it. So, but they are incredible. But to watch, they are absolutely just, they, I mean, I can watch them for a long time. So that this red one in front of me now, so it's a red colour. They like to have something to grip onto. So often if people are keeping them in Petri dishes, they will use, they will sandpaper the bottom of the Petri dish so they've got something to grip. I'm still trying to work out whether the tardigrade swim. I don't know what the official line is, and I haven't found anybody. So they walk, for sure, and they grip onto things. But whether they can swim between spaces, I'm still not sure, or whether they just fall between spaces. Right. I don't know quite what they've got going on there. But you can often see what they've eaten inside them, because you can. But in terms of identifying, I haven't got as far as that, but I've got friends on Twitter now who I can see are regularly identifying them. And you look at the shapes of their claws and the arrangement of their claws on their eight legs and their mouth parts, their buccal cavity. They've got a particular area there that they're able to, the shapes and forms are the two key ways of identifying them, which is something I'd love to get into. You know, I'm too busy just having another job, really.
Of course, yeah.
But you know,
one day,
absolutely, another day. So I'm always fascinated by that. So that's them. But you know, they can extra, and so that ton state is something we're fascinated with.
You can now make donations to help offset the running costs of this podcast. If you're enjoying Grubbing the Filth and want to make a donation, like a benevolent Victorian, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/grubbingcast. Or you can also write a brief message if you so wish. Any donations are truly appreciated. Thank you. These are microscopic animals, right? The nematode and the tardigrade. Without your microscope, you wouldn't be able to see them. Is that right?
That's correct.
And I think that when I think of microscopic life, the nematode and the tardigrade, and these other things, these other animals, that's the word I'm looking for, that you're looking at, are just that. They're animals. And you've mentioned nervous systems, and you've mentioned that they're multicellular. And I think that with animals that exist in this level, there's a temptation to think of them as, because of that scale, as something distinct from the other animals that we think of. You know, animals span from the blue whale down to this scale, right? And these are still, you know, the tardigrade, whilst exceptionally small, in some ways isn't, this is a mad thing to say, isn't enormously dissimilar from much more relatable animals and much more familiar animals. It's just a lot smaller, right?
Absolutely. And I do, I mean, it is fascinating to see these. So, you know, 1,000 cells in a tardigrade, you know, we know that that's how many cells they have. And, you know, a blue whale or ourselves, you know, we're talking billions and billions of cells.
Sure.
But there's organization in there. The cells are organized. They make up one organism. There's systems within that that allow it to function. And the interesting about the nematodes, by, you know, a lot of the genes they've got have got similarities to our genes. So particularly the aging ones, we're able to learn a lot from those. So they're very simple versions, if you like, of the larger organisms. But I find the more I read, the more things that are I look at the microscope are actually more representative of what life on Earth is like than what we think life is like in terms of humans. We think humans and blue whales and things are typical, but they're not. It's, you know, the typical life is a cell or a small bunch of cells swimming around in there. The other thing I suppose that is quite interesting, because you think, look through a microscope, you will see cells. And you do, and there's lots of single cells swimming around. In fact, a lot of the cells, well, some of the cells I see swim past are larger than the tardigrade, which is 1,000 cells big. And I find that mind-boggling every time I see this giant, what appears to be a giant cell going past a tardigrade, which could cover it easily. You know, it's just, I just find that sense of scale mind-boggling. So you think animals, then you think cells, you know, in terms of size and scale. But actually, there are cells that are bigger than animals on this scale.
I was thinking about the fact that, you know, you run these workshops in schools. And when I was at school, I feel like every year there was always having a look at onion cells under a microscope was one of the big things you did. I mean, the ones that you're looking at now, do you have any sense of, when you say the cells swimming past, do you have any sense of, just to get understand the environment these animals are living within. What are these cells? Do you know?
Yeah. I say yeah really confidently. No. I know that I know there are lots of them, and I am learning them. So there's some really clear ones. So paramecium, people might have heard of, and there's euglena as well, which is a photosynthetic cell. It's got red eye. It's quite clear to see. There's lots that swim around that I'm still learning about. And there's some pretty key ones that actually, so you could call them ciliates or flagellates. So the ciliates are covered in hair-like projections and use them to move, to funnel food, to do all sorts of things. So they're cells covered in cilia. And then you've got the flagellates that usually use just a single or double long whip-like projection, hair-like projection, mm-hmm. to swim around. So you can see them, I can classify them that far, but then there are some others. So there's grazers, I call the grazers. Now, when I first started doing this, I said to myself, I don't want to bog myself down with all the names. I'm going to give them my own name. So I've got things that I call hairy racers, which are some sort of hippotrich, which races around, and they're covered in hair, cilia, and they zoom around. They're just mad, and there's no point chasing them because you can't keep up with them, so you just have to watch them go past. But there's other more sedate ones as well that will just graze over the debris in there. But also you will see them, so when a rotifer dies, all these animals have cuticles, an external sort of skeleton type thing, an external skin, and you will see that these organisms move into the dead rotifer, and they'll be inside eating the remains. And so you're seeing food chains in action. And if you know anything about cells, when they are feeding, if you like, they produce something called vesicles that look like bubbles. They're bubbles of digestive juices or enzymes, basically. And so these organisms in there are bubbling with the digestive juices and the vesicles. And so they're really, it's really amazing. Again, it's something you just sit and watch for, you know, I can be here for a good 20 minutes watching it or recording it or whatever, and just working out what's going on in there. So yeah, so we're going, you know, in terms of food chains and stuff, you know, this is really fascinating, and how these animals all work together. So, yeah.
What the listener does not realise is that both of us are wearing tan shorts and button-up shirts and pith helmets, and we need to get back to our safari.
We do. So
you actually mentioned just then another one of the animals that lives in this environment, which is the rotifer, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I do feel like the rotifer gets sidelined to the tardigrade. So I seem to get belloid rotifers in my samples, which are which means leech-like. Rotifer means animal, wheel animal. So let me just explain what you might see. So I've got one just here. Well, I've got two in different states here. So I've got one that has sort of curled up. And she, and I know she's she, because there are only female ones. So right. These only exist in female form. And so they're fascinating genetically and fascinating reproductively as well. This one here is just retracted, looks like a little ball. I can see that she's moving slightly. There's a little bit of movement going on inside. I can see some movements in her guts. And one of the key things I look for is their jaws. So they have these internal jaws, which are two little hard parts that open and close in a muscle, which are within the body, because the way they get food in their body is, so we've got this dormant state at the moment, and what she'll do, she'll stretch out, and she's got two toes one end of her, which she uses to latch onto to the substrate, and then she will open up when she's ready her two wheel organs, which are basically ciliated organs that spin round. They don't actually spin, but they look like they're spinning. So the organization of the hairs move in a sequence so that they look like they're turning very fast, and they create a massive current, and they draw in all the debris, all the small organisms that they can eat, and they go through the jaws. And if you get a really good one, you can see the debris being drawn in, you can see the waste coming out of the jaws that they're not having, that just sort of gets, and then the rest goes into the guts. And of course you can see everything going in because these are transparent organisms. As soon as they're disturbed, they will retract. They also will move from place to place. So often when I get a leaf, as soon as I get a leaf, as soon as they get a leaf, I can see the rotifers all over the leaf, moving around, stretching out, and they move like a leech, and that's why they're called leech lights. So they put they fold away their wheel organs, and then they move the head, put the head down, move their tail at the tail end forward, and then the head end again, like an inchworm, and that's how they move around. And you'll see them crawling over leaves and so on for that. The other thing is about, you know, they go into a cryptobiotic state as well. So they will contract, they will go through some biochemical changes to protect themselves from freezing or whatever it is. And there's been some fascinating research in Siberia where they do the ice cores. You know, the ice cores where they drill down and they go back thousands and thousands of years. Well, they pulled up this one, and they got some rotifers. They found some rotifers, woke them up, and she started moving around. They started moving around and reproduced. And these were 24,000 years old. 24,000 years. And that just blows my mind that something can just go into a status for that long. Now, there's also some really interesting stuff as well, because the biochemistry of the cells there, they don't actually age in that time. So if you are, say you live for 2 years as a rotifer normally, so your normal lifespan is 2 years, that if you are awake for, I don't know, 18 months, and then you go into a great, you know, the freeze comes and you go into your state, you've still got, after 24,000 years, you've still got your 6 months left that you can live. You know, you've still got that time to do that. And I find that absolutely mind-boggling that you've got, you know, this sort of finite life, but you can have this rest period, this hibernation period, and just be woken up. I mean, it must be very disconcerting.
I'm sure, yeah. They are on that kind of that brink of life and death, right? They are completely dormant for all that time, just waiting for the right conditions, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's just, yeah, it just fascinates me. I don't know whether people have watched, you know, the X-Files. I used to watch a lot, and, you know, there's always this thing about waking up something that perhaps we shouldn't wake up. I always wonder, you know, what else we will find in there.
It's some thought, well, fingers crossed that one day I can do an episode about whatever it is.
Absolutely, they wake up.
Yeah, and when the debris cleared, I'll do my best to find someone to talk about it. But the rotifer, it's got, so what you're saying, when you describe the wheel organ, it looks almost like, under a microscope, like a sort of a industrial grinder or something like that, like a mangle, where you've got these two, what appear to be wheels with kind of hairs coming off them, like cogs, looking like, and you kind of allude to the fact that they're not doing this, but looking like they're rotating and drawing food in. So are these not actually wheels in the strictest sense then?
No. They're not wheels, from what I can tell. They are just hairs that are moving in a very organized way, like in a Mexican wave, you know, so you've got that sort of movement where things are creating a current. So they move in a way that creates a current in the water. So it produces a wave of motion, if you like, through those hairs. So it's very highly coordinated. I mean, it's fascinating that in itself, you know, how cells do that. But it's a very common thing you see, particularly in the moss world, where we've got single cells that do the same thing. They've got a wheel organ, something called vorticella, which does exactly the same thing, but only has a single sort of wheel that it brings in its food with.
You mentioned we've got the big five here, and
the
rotifer, the tardigrade, and the nematode. That's kind of where my understanding of what's going on here sort of ends. So beyond those three, it's a big five, right? So what's left on our list?
Absolutely. So we have the moss mite, which I've done loads of reading on just in the last couple of weeks. So the moss mite is a mite, as you imagine. So an arthropod, it's got the eight legs, and it looks like a mite, how you'd expect. So quite a large body, those six legs all up at the front, and a sort of pointy head end. They're obviously not insects, so they've got they've got a sort of single head. There's no sort of real thorax as such, and then the abdomen's quite got all the main organs in. But they're quite heavily plated, so these often appear very dark. They're often the largest organism I will see, so they will take up they can be up to a millimeter, so they will take up quite a bit of my screen space when I see one. Occasionally, if they're that big, some of them are smaller. They're in different instars as well, so different states as they grow. So I find these fascinating because they survive. A lot of them aren't associated directly with the moss. They go to moss for moisture, to protect themselves from UV radiation as well, which is something I was quite fascinated by. And sometimes they go in there to breed, and other times they go in there to feed. So they will move out of the moss when it starts to dry out. So, you know, they don't like... They've got quite thick shells, exoskeletons, so they can actually survive a bit of dehydration, but they will go and hide in, say, the crevices on a tree or something like that, rather than stay in the moss. So we have some that do stay in moss and are able to survive, but I think they survive in the egg state rather than in the whole organism right. state. We have some that visit, just pop by for a bit of shelter or a bit of food, and others are just sort of incidental. It just so happens that they're walking across moss when I've picked one up and other people are picking up that bit of moss. They just happen to be going past. And I'm fascinated by anatomy. Suddenly I've got really interested in anatomy because now I've got more into it. I can see different parts, and they have these different plates on their bodies, and they even have a sort of wing case that overhangs slightly. They call them wings, these sort of bits that overhang. But the legs, I've been trying to get my, because I'm trying to draw what I see, because I observe things much better when I'm trying to draw them. And I hadn't realized, and it must be true for a lot of arthropods, but they actually have one of the leg parts. It's called the patella, which is the knee, and things like that just really surprised me. I just go, oh gosh, okay, yeah, we're giving it the same name. But the claws in these organisms, particularly in moss, seem to be quite an important thing, because you have to sort of move through the moss, and usually the claws really help you. So I'm quite interested by those. I thought that they were predators of rotifers and tardigrades, which some are, but more often they are grazers. So they will just be eating the moss leaves themselves and things like that. So they're not always as they're not always predators. There we go. Which is what I assumed they were, because they look quite menacing when they're strolling across your slide.
Sure. I mean, that a mite is a. This is kind of the first time we've come into slightly more familiar territory, maybe, in that a mite is an arachnid, right? So it's just small form of arachnid that's living within this strange environment.
Absolutely. Now, somebody that didn't make the big five, which you'll see occasionally, are the springtails. But I did include the springtails because they're often over a millimetre. But one of my earliest memories, that's a lot. One of the early bits of my recent studies was when I didn't know what everything was what I called the blue monster, because this big blue thing started just roaming across my field of view with these large antenna and a blue head, a very bluey colour. And it turned out to be one of the, a columboida? Columboida? One of those.
Yes, columbula.
Yep, that's the one. Yep, I knew there was a word. So that's one of those. And there are some that are very associated with mosses, but again, a lot are incidental. So they're a sort of sideline. So they didn't get quite into the top five, but possibly they could have done. And the last one is a bit elusive to me, but okay. I've got colleagues that have that in their moss, if you like. My moss doesn't seem to have many of them, but they're called gastroriches, which means hairy belly, which are basically like flatworms, which are covered in cilia, and they just dart around. I've seen one, never caught them on film. They move quite fast. And so I still don't know where they should be in my big five, because it's not really quite my big five, but other people do find them. So I'm always interested to see those. But again, they are, they feed in the moss, they move around. And I don't know much about their cryptobiology, if they've got any and stuff like that, but that you will find them in a... there's been a lot of work done on sphagnum moss, particularly about the organisms that live in it, and they're very popular, is that the right word, very abundant in a lot of the sphagnum moss as well. They're not actual worms, they're they are just their own thing. Like tardigrades don't really fit into any box as such. They don't seem to have a related, you know, in the big chain of life, and they don't seem to fit it. They're their own thing. They don't sort of, they're not related direct. Well, they're obviously related to something somewhere, but you know, yes, they form their own very unique way of surviving, and then adaptations, their own species of being what they are.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I was doing a bit of reading before this, and the tardigrade, wherever it kind of fits into the tree of life, isn't particularly well kind of, it's not been solidified, I guess, right?
And it's highly debated, yes, highly debated, yeah.
So it's possibly it's some kind of branching path before the rest of the arthropods. But my vague sense is that it's kind of a branching path before the velvet worms branch from the arthropods, and it's way back there somewhere, possibly, but no one's quite sure. It's very much not an arachnid, it's not a tiny insect, it's something of its own.
And this, absolutely,
the gasteriches as well, they're having an independent life, is that right?
Well, yeah, they sort of, I mean, I think we've got a clearer link with where they come in, but the tardigrade particularly is one of those enigmas at the moment. And I think that's why we find it's quite fascinating. It is like nothing else we see, you know. It's like no other. It reminds me of the platypus, because it's got bits of everything. It's got that sort of snouty nose like a pig, and then those big claws like a bear, and a big soft body. You know, it looks like somebody's just put something together to try and make it look cute.
Yes. Well, the tardigrade, more so than the other ones we've mentioned, is quite familiar in its form. It's quite animalian. It's got legs. It's got a face, as it were. Whereas the others look kind of more like cells almost, though they're not. Yep. I mean, I was going to ask you, you know, this is our safari, but I was going to ask you about is there any sort of white whale within the Moss Safari world, like a thing that you haven't seen that you always hope to find on your explorations? Is it the gasterich?
Right, well, the gasterich is definitely something on my list, and I'm always hoping to see one of those, just because I don't see them very often. There's a single-celled thing called I think it's a lacrimara, a word like that, which has a swan neck, and so it produces a really long neck with a sort of mouth part at the end that it captures other single-celled organisms with, and I think they must be amazing to actually see. But definitely the gasterich is the one that I'd be absolutely amazed to see. But to be honest, whenever I see a tardigrade, it's always an amazing moment. And, you know, I don't know whether I'm ever going to get bored of tardigrades. Whereas rotifers, I will sort of overlook a bit now because they're, you know, they're pretty ubiquitous. Not when I'm doing a Moss Safari, because I want to show other people, but, you know, I will, you know, I scan past quite a few. Whereas whenever you see a tardigrade, you stop and have a look and try and have a closer look at what's going on.
Of course. So in terms of abundance, I mean, if someone's listening and they haven't, let's imagine that someone's listening and they're walking through a wood right now, or through a park or whatever, and there's a bit of moss between some bricks or on a rock or wherever this moss happens to be, moss gets about. Is it fair to say, you know, they haven't got a microscope, but if you run your finger across a piece of moss now, it's pretty much guaranteed that within that moss you're touching, there will be rotifers, there will be nematodes, there will be these animals. They're not...
Absolutely.
They're absolutely abundant creatures.
I'm very interested about the differences in the abundance. I mean, there's a lot of there's temperature, there's moisture and stuff, which will vary. But I'm also interested in urban moss and whether there's difference in the abundance of these organisms in moss that suffers more pollution, for example, or stuff that's more rural. So I would love to get to some schools together in different environments to actually compare and see if there's any difference in distribution. But yeah, basically, whenever I go past a piece of moss now, I'm always wondering, definitely rotifers will be in there, definitely nematodes. There's a good chance that you will find a tardigrade or two. You might find different types of tardigrade as well. And then the moss mites, I get them every now and again. They're not And I don't know whether they're seasonal. I'm still trying to work out whether they are actually seasonal, whether I'd get more of them in the spring rather than the winter. I'm trying to work that out at the moment. So as you say, I've got lots of questions. I'm not an expert. There might be people out there going, oh, moss mites only come out in June and July. So, you know, I'm very happy to be told otherwise all the time.
So when you're looking at this world under the microscope and this big five and all these animals, just the life that you see when you look at them, because you're having to flush them out of their environment, you're not really seeing them as they live day to day, because you wouldn't be able to visualize them. Is that fair to say?
That's very true. Yes.
So you're not, the behavior you see from them, they're not fish out of water, but they are in that kind of that sense, they have been removed from the place they want to be. Yep. So are you able to kind of see their behavior? You know what I mean? Can you see what they're doing? And does that in any way feel familiar or relatable?
Yeah, well, it's a really odd thing because something I would love to be able to do, and I don't know whether they exist, and they're probably really expensive, but if you could get a tiny, tiny, weeny one of those sort of endoscopes, and I'd love to be able to explore moss with one of those. And I'm doing more and more with taking just a stem of a piece of moss and trying to look at it to try and get some sort of sense. Because as you say, what I've done is I've just wrecked the world they live in, turned it upside down, squeezed it out and slapped it onto a slide. But it's odd because a lot of the fascinating thing is a lot of things are still just feeding. They're just getting on with their own thing. You know, they're getting on with what they do. I think you see all the things you'd expect to see. So reproduction, examples of reproduction, you see examples of feeding, you see things moving around. So their world is a bit turned up. I do often feel that the tardigrades are probably the most sort of disorientated because they seem to just do this continual sort of crawling when they're active. And I can't quite work out whether that's normal behavior or whether they're just like, well, this is a little, you know, I'm just trying to get a purchase on something. The rotifers don't seem to care. They just carry on feeding. They still come out with their wheel organs and they crawl around the leaves and so on. So it is difficult to know. You obviously have disturbed their world, but they seem to just carry on functioning as they would. I should imagine the bright light upsets them as well, because they don't really like bright light, which obviously is an important part of the microscope to be able to see them. I'm starting to piece together behaviors and start to piece together who eats what and when and so on. So that's my approach. That's my understanding of the behavior at the moment. I still can imagine food chains. I still can imagine the relationship between the organisms and the moss itself, which is a really important thing to always keep in mind, how they're related to the moss and how the moss works together. And I suppose that leads into something else I find fascinating. And this is the thing about moss, you know, the co-evolution over millions of years, is that the reproduction of moss quite likely relies on some of these organisms actually effectively being pollinators. So a moss produces sperm, which people don't often realize. So they produce their male gametes have got a tail and they do swim. But they have to swim quite far to get to the female gamete. And they found that tardigrades will actually transport the sperm cells, and they are actually attracted to some sort of pheromone produced by the female gametes, and will take basically the sperm over to the female gametes. So and go and eat or whatever. I don't know what they do, but they're attracted to the pheromone produced by that the female gamete. So I just find that amazing that they've got some sort of co-evolution going on, as you would have in the you know, we see it between flowers and insects all the time, but it's actually happening within moss as well.
It sounds like this whole world of moss, which I'm becoming increasingly enthusiastic about as I'm listening. I now want to go and do a bit of a moss safari myself. And you know, as someone who works in the classroom, I'm thinking, you know, this has got to be one of those ways that we can make invertebrate worlds and frankly other worlds, alien worlds that exist around us, really quite accessible. I mean, you obviously need microscopes, and you need to what extent you need powerful microscopes, expensive microscopes, I don't know. I mean, can you tell me a little bit about bringing Mosafaris into the classroom and kind of how you do that? And maybe there's people out there who might want to reach out to you and bring you in or even put on their own Mosafari.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of demand for it, which is lovely. So I just went to, I was at heads of science teachers meeting very recently. And I did just a very quick Mosafari. And, you know, you've got a bunch of adults who are all, you know, they're teachers, they're heads of science, you know, they've done their job, they've seen it all, you know, they know what's going on. And they were wowing and whooping over the organisms we were seeing, and I do it projected onto a screen, just through the interactive whiteboard type thing, through my microscope. Now my microscope's a little bit better than the ones you would get in school, but you still can see all these organisms using the secondary school microscopes. With the primary style microscopes, you get it. You can see rotifers and nematodes. And maybe the odd tardigrade if it's large enough, but they often just look like little white threads or little white worms or whatever. You don't get quite the magnification you need to sort of see them thoroughly, although the children still find it amazing. I've gone into primary schools and into secondary schools, and usually I do a demonstration at the front and take them on a Mosafari, which can take 30 minutes, and we just go across a slide, live from the Mos. You might find stuff, you might not. A lot of the things I've been telling you about, I talk to the children about. Often the schools want a particular focus, so adaptations is quite common in primary schools. In secondary schools, I can go into other things as well, so food chains, ecology, but also I can talk about careers and the opportunities in science, which is a key thing for me, the fact that this science is not done. There's room out there for you in science. Go out there. This is just a drop of water from moss we found outside. There's so much we don't know about the organisms that live in there. So that's the big message I've got. So I will talk about those things. And then often the class can have a chance to do a Mosafari themselves with their own microscope. Sometimes I take in my own pre-prepared moss juice because it's just quicker to give them that, but others will produce it, will use the moss from their school or bring in their own moss to do it. This is a sideline for me, so it's very hard to get out to other places that are further away from where I live in the south of England. So I've tried to produce resources that teachers can use. So they're all freely downloadable on my website. You can just download the resource. It's got technician notes. It's got the how to do it sheet, so the instruction sheet, and it's got the big five, what to look for both primary and secondary of what to look for, and there's some activities to do as well. So I've sort of developed those as time goes on. So I would encourage teachers to do it themselves. The other thing that's happening really nicely is on Twitter, I've got a hashtag called Mosafari ID. And when other teachers are doing their own Mosafari, if they either want to confirm what they found or just show off what they found, because people get very excited about finding their own tardigrade, the first tardigrade, then they put that on Twitter and I can see, and I will respond, and if they don't know what it is, I'll also ask, try and find out, which is the bit that really fascinates me. So I started that in Science Week this year, and it's been really successful. I'm getting one or two inquiries a week, which is enough to keep me going. But you know, if people want to do that, then please do. And even if you're not a school, you know, if you're someone doing it on your own, you just want to confirm what you found, just put that on, because I'm always happy to engage with that sort of interaction.
Where can people get in touch with you or see, you mentioned your website, what are the kind of resources that people can access at the moment if they want to go on a Mosafari?
So going on a Mosafari is very simple. You need a microscope and you need some moss, basically. It's ideal to have a microscope slide that's got a little well in it, which are really easy to get hold of. But if you don't have those, there's other ways of doing it. And they are detailed on some of the sheets as well. But basically, my website is a WordPress blog and it's got it's called Mossafari. If you type WordPress and Mossafari and it comes up, if you go to my Twitter account, which is @Mossafari, that will that's got a link on it as well for you. I've got a Facebook page as well and Instagram. Again, both of those are called Mossafari, so you can find them quite easily. Then that will take you to links to the resources. And there's basically a Google Drive where you can go and download. There's ready-made PowerPoints, there's ready-made worksheets, and there's a little primary booklet that you can use for primary school children to look at colour in different different parts, different organs, different things like that of the Big Five. So they're getting an idea of adaptations and body systems and things like that.
Well, speaking as a teacher, can I just say, you know, a ready-made PowerPoint, a ready-made worksheet, this is the grail, and this is what we're all after. So thank you for putting that out there. I'd like to, it's been so wonderful to talk to you, Andrew, and thank you for sharing your expertise and for sharing all this mossy goodness. It sounds amazing. And, you know, go out and have a look at these pictures of these animals, because it's lovely to hear about them, but what you really want to do is go and have a look at one. And I'd encourage anyone listening to do that. I'd like to ask you before you go, this is a very much a hypothetical question, but let's say that we can shrink ourselves down. You know, we are entering the world of the moss in person, and we've gained some kind of capacity to speak to the rotifer, to speak to the tardigrade, and to ask a question. And we're going to get a good answer here. Is there any kind of question that, if you had the capacity to learn the answer about the world of the moss, or about the animals that live there, what question would you most like to have answered, do you think?
Yeah, that's an amazing, a big old question. I used to do scuba diving, and it reminds me of just going and sitting at the bottom. I always want to sit and let the wildlife come to me rather than do all the swimming around. And I'd love to do that. Just go and park yourself on the bottom, you know, just on the roots of the rhizoids of the moss, and just watch the world going by of what's going on there. I suppose you'd have to talk to a tardigrade about, you know, I don't know whether it's about life. You know, their perception of life is going to be very different to ours. But this whole idea of just existing when you can, and then other times just sort of phasing out for a bit until everything's okay. I think I'm fascinated by that. But also, I suppose, what is life in moss like? I'd like to shadow one, I suppose. You know, this idea right. That they will transport sperm and transport, you know, what else, how else do they work in that environment? What is their niche? What is their place? What is their role in that environment? So I think that I'd find that very interesting. Not necessarily, I'd perhaps go in not asking questions, but go in with an ethnographic approach of just, you know, trying to experience what it is to be a tardigrade. To do, but I think if I went that small, they'd be really scary, because those claws are huge. You often think, you know, I'd be quite terrified if I was the size of a tardigrade down there, because those claws could do a lot of damage, I reckon.
100%. Well, and you know, they look like bears. That's where they get the little nickname from, right? So I can imagine absolutely. It would be quite an imposing thing. Well, I think that's a really good answer. The idea of understanding what it's like to live another life is a difficult question to answer, right? But if we could shadow a tardigrade like an NQT mentor, that'd be a wonderful thing to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But Andrew, thank you so much for speaking to me today. It's been really wonderful to hear about all the life going on within the moss. And yeah, again, I'd encourage anyone to go on the website or just to take a moment to have a look at some moss and think very carefully about the things that existed in this.
But thank you so much for having me. I love talking about this, and I hope it inspires a lot of other people to get out there and just look at moss in a different way and all the organisms that live in there. They survive. A lot of them aren't associated directly with the moss. They go to moss for moisture, to protect themselves from UV radiation. As well, which is something I was quite fascinated by. And sometimes they go in there to breed, and other times they go in there to feed. So they will move out of the moss when it starts to dry out. So, you know, they don't like, they can't tolerate. They've got quite thick shells, so well, exoskeletons, so they can actually survive a bit of dehydration, but they will go and hide in, say, the crevices on a tree or something like that, rather than stay in the moss. So we have some that do stay in moss and are able to survive, but I think they survive in the egg state rather than in the whole organism right. state. We have some that visit, just pop by for a bit of shelter or a bit of food, and others are just sort of incidental. It just so happens that they're walking across moss when I've picked one up and other people are picking up that bit of moss, they just happen to be going past. There's a lot to learn, and I'm fascinated by anatomy. Suddenly I've got really interested in anatomy, because now I've got more into it, I can see different parts, and they have these different plates on their bodies, and they even have a sort of wing case that overhangs slightly. They call them wings, these sort of bits that overhang. But the legs, I've been trying to get my, because I'm trying to draw what I see, because I observe things much better when I'm trying to draw them. And I hadn't realized, and it must be true for a lot of arthropods, but they actually have one of the leg parts. It's called the patella, which is the knee, and things like that just really surprised me. I just go, oh gosh, okay, yeah, we're giving it the same name. But the claws in these organisms, particularly in moss, seem to be quite an important thing, because you have to sort of move through the moss, and usually the claws really help you. So I'm quite interested by those. I thought that they were predators of rotifers and tardigrades, which some are, but more often they are grazers. So they will just be eating the moss leaves themselves and things like that. So they're not always as they're not always predators. There we go. Which is what I assumed they were, because they look quite menacing when they're strolling across your slide.
Sure. I mean, that a mite is a. This is kind of the first time we've come into slightly more familiar territory, maybe, in that a mite is an arachnid, right? So it's just small form of arachnid that's living within this strange environment.
Absolutely. Now, somebody that didn't make the big five, which you will see occasionally, are the springtails. But I did include the springtails because they're often over a millimetre. But one of my earliest memories, that's a lot. One of the early bits of my recent studies was when I didn't know what everything was what I called the blue monster, because this big blue thing started just roaming across my field of view with these large what do you call them, antenna and a blue head, a very bluey colour. And it turned out to be one of the, is it a columboida? One of those.
Yes, columbula.
Yep, that's the one. Yep, there was I knew there was a word. So that's one of those. And there are some that are very associated with mosses, but again, a lot are incidental. And there's somebody on Twitter that takes amazing photos of these, all the different types. I can't remember the name of them, but they're a sort of sideline. So they didn't get quite into the top five, but possibly they could have done. And the last one is a bit elusive to me, but okay. I've got colleagues that have it in their moss, if you like. My moss doesn't seem to have many of them, but they're called gastroriches, which are means hairy belly, which are basically like flatworms, which are covered in cilia, and they just dart around. I've seen one, never caught them on film. They move quite fast. And so I still don't know whether they should be in my big five, because it's not really quite my big five, but other people do find them. So I'm always interested to see those. But again, they are, they feed in the moss, they move around. And I don't know much about their cryptobiology, if they've got any and stuff like that, but that you will find them in there's been a lot of work done on sphagnum moss, particularly about the organisms that live in it, and they're very popular, is that the right word, very abundant in a lot of the sphagnum moss as well. So that's the big five.
And I mean, that can you tell me the name of that last one again, please?
A gastrich.
That's what I've heard of.
No, I hadn't either. So, yeah, again, they're sort of wormy. They're not actual worms. They are just their own thing. Like tardigrades don't really fit into any box as such. They don't seem to have a related, in the big chain of life. And they don't seem to fit it. They're their own thing. They don't sort of, they're not related direct. Well, they're obviously related to something somewhere. But, they form their own very unique way of surviving and then adaptations, their own species of being what they are.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I was doing a bit of reading before this, and the tardigrade, wherever it kind of fits into the tree of life, isn't particularly well kind of, it's not been solidified, I guess, right?
And it's highly somewhere, debated, yes, highly yeah. debated, yeah.
But my vague sense is that there's kind of a branching path before the velvet worms branch from the arthropods, and it's yep. way back there somewhere, possibly, but no one's quite sure. It's very much not an, it's not an arachnid, it's not a tiny insect, it's something of its own.
And this, absolutely,
the gasteriches as well, they kind of, they're having an independent life, is that right?
Well, yeah, they so. I mean, I think they've got we've got a clearer link with what where they come in, but the tardigrade particularly is one of those enigmas at the moment. And I think that's why we find it quite fascinating. It's like nothing else we see. You know, it's like no other. It reminds me of the platypus because it's got bits of everything. It's got it's got that sort of snouty nose like a pig, and then those big claws like a bear, and a big soft body. You know, it looks like somebody's just put something together to try and make it look cute.
Yes. Well, the tardigrade, more so than the other ones we've mentioned, is quite familiar in its form. It's quite animalian. It's got legs. It's got a face, as it were. Whereas the others look kind of more like cells almost, though they're not. Yep. I mean, I was going to ask you, you know, this is our safari, but I was going to ask you about a kind of, is there any sort of white whale within the Moss Safari world, like a thing that you haven't seen that you always hope to find on your explorations? Is it the gasterich?
Right, well, the gasterich is definitely something on my list, and I'm always hoping to see one of those just because I don't see them very often. There's a single-celled thing called I think it's a lacrimara, a word like that, which has a swan neck. And so it produces a really long neck with a sort of mouth part at the end that it captures other single-celled organisms with. And I think they must be amazing to actually see. But definitely the gasterich is the one that I'd be absolutely amazed to see. But to be honest, whenever I see a tardigrade, it's always an amazing moment. And you know, I don't know whether I'm ever going to get bored of tardigrades, whereas rotifers I will sort of overlook a bit now because they're, you know, they're pretty ubiquitous. Not when I'm doing a Moss Safari because I want to show other people, but you know, I will, you know, I scan past quite a few, whereas whenever you see a tardigrade, you stop and have a look and try and have a closer look at what's going on.
Of course. So in terms of abundance, I mean, if someone's listening and they haven't, let's imagine that someone's listening and they're walking through a wood right now or through a park or whatever, and there's a bit of moss between some bricks or on a rock or wherever this moss happens to be, moss gets about. Is it fair to say, you know, they haven't got a microscope, but if you run your finger across a piece of moss now, it's pretty much guaranteed that within that moss you're touching, there will be rotifers, there will be nematodes, there will be these animals. They're not...
Absolutely.
They're absolutely abundant creatures.
I'm very interested about the differences in the abundance. I mean, there's a lot of there's temperature, there's moisture and stuff which will vary. But I'm also interested in urban moss and whether there's difference in the abundance of these organisms in moss that suffers more pollution, for example, or stuff that's more rural. So I would love to get to some schools together in different environments to actually compare and see if there's any difference in distribution. But yeah, basically, whenever I go past a piece of moss now, I'm always wondering, definitely rotifers will be in there, definitely nematodes. There's a good chance that you'll find a tardigrade or two. You might find different types of tardigrade as well. And then the moss mites, I get them every now and again. And I don't know whether they're seasonal. I'm still trying to work out whether they are actually seasonal, whether I'd get more of them in the spring rather than the winter. I'm trying to work that out at the moment. So as I say, I've got lots of questions. I'm not an expert. There might be people out there going, oh, moss mites only come out in June and July. So, you know, I'm very happy to be told otherwise all the time.
So when you're looking at this world under the microscope and this big five and all these animals, just the life that you see when you look at them, because you're having to flush them out of their environment, you're not really seeing them as they
as they live day to day, because you wouldn't be able to visualise them. Is that fair to say?
That's very true, yes. Go on.
So the behaviour you see from them, they're not fish out of water, but they are, in that kind of, that sense, they have been removed from the place they want to be. Yep. So are you able to kind of see their behaviour? You know what I mean? Can you see what they're doing? And does that in any way feel familiar or relatable?
I think you see all the things you'd expect to see. So reproduction, examples of reproduction, you see examples of feeding, you see things moving around. So their world is a bit turned up. I do often feel that the tardigrades are probably the most sort of disorientated, because they seem to just do this continual sort of crawling when they're active. And I can't quite work out whether that's normal behavior or whether they're just like, well, this is a little, you know, I'm just trying to get a purchase on something. The rotifers don't seem to care. They just carry on feeding. They still come out with their wheel organs and they crawl around the leaves and so on. So it is difficult to know. You obviously have disturbed their world, but they seem to just carry on functioning as they would. I should imagine the bright light upsets them as well, because they don't really like bright light, which obviously is an important part of the microscope to be able to see them. I'm starting to piece together behaviours and start to piece together who eats what and when and so on. So that's my approach. That's my understanding of the behaviour at the moment. I still can imagine food chains. I still can imagine the relationship between the organisms and the moss itself, which is a really important thing to always keep in mind, how they're related to the moss and how the moss works together. And I suppose that leads into something else I find fascinating. And this is the thing about moss, you know, the co-evolution over millions of years, is that the reproduction of moss quite likely relies on some of these organisms actually effectively being pollinators. So a moss produces sperm, which people don't often realize. So they produce their male gametes have got a tail and they do swim, but they have to swim quite far to get to the female gamete. And they found that tardigrades will actually transport the sperm cells, and they are actually attracted to some sort of pheromone produced by the female gametes, and will take basically the sperm over to the female gametes. So eat or whatever. I don't know what they do, but they're attracted to the pheromone produced by that the female gamete. So I just find that amazing, that they've got some sort of co-evolution going on, as you would have in the we see it between flowers and insects all the time, but it's actually happening within moss as well.
I now want to go and do a bit of a moss safari myself. And, you know, as someone who works in the classroom, I'm thinking, you know, this has got to be one of those ways that we can make invertebrate worlds and frankly, other worlds, alien worlds that exist around us, really quite accessible. I mean, you obviously you need microscopes, and you need, to what extent you need powerful microscopes, expensive microscopes, I don't know. I mean, can you tell me a little bit about bringing moss safaris into the classroom and kind of how you do that? And maybe the people out there who might want to reach out to you and bring you in, or even put on their own moss safari.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of demand for it, which is lovely. So I just went to, I was at heads of science, science teachers meeting very recently. And I did just a very quick moss safari. And, you know, you've got a bunch of adults who are all, you know, they're teachers, they're heads of science, you know, they've done their job, they've seen it all, you know, they know what's going on. And they were wowing and whooping over the organisms we were seeing, and I do it projected onto a screen, just through the interactive whiteboard type thing, through my microscope. Now my microscope's a little bit better than the ones you would get in school, but you still can see all these organisms using the secondary school microscopes. With the primary style microscopes you get, you can see rotifers and nematodes, and maybe the odd tardigrade if it's large enough, but they often just look like little white threads or little white worms or whatever. You don't get quite the magnification you need to sort of see them thoroughly, although the children still find it amazing to capture these things themselves.
It's been so wonderful to talk to you, Andrew, and thank you for sharing your expertise and for sharing all this mossy goodness. It sounds amazing. And, you know, go out and have a look at these pictures of these animals, because it's lovely to hear about them, but what you really want to do is go and have a look at one. And I'd encourage anyone listening to do that. I'd like to ask you before you go, this is very much a hypothetical question, but let's say that we can shrink ourselves down. You know, we are entering the world of the moss in person, and we've gained some kind of capacity to speak to the rotifer, to speak to the tardigrade, and to ask a question. And we're going to get a good answer here. Is there any kind of question that, if you had the capacity to learn the answer about the world of the moss, or about the animals that live there, what question would you most like to have answered, do you think?
Yeah, that's an amazing, a big old question. I used to do scuba diving, and it reminds me of just going and sitting at the bottom. I always want to sit and let the wildlife come to me rather than do all the swimming around. And I'd love to do that. Just go and park yourself on the bottom, you know, just on the roots of the rhizoids of the moss, and just watch the world going by of what's going on there. I suppose you'd have to talk to a tardigrade about, you know, I don't know whether it's about life, you know, their perception of life is going to be very different to ours. But this whole idea of just existing when you can, and then other times just sort of phasing out for a bit until everything's okay. I think I'm fascinated by that. But also, I suppose, what is life in moss like? I'd like to shadow one, I suppose. You know, this idea that they will transport sperm and transport, you know, how else do they work in that environment? What is their niche? What is their place? What is their role in that environment? So I think that I'd find that very interesting. Not necessarily, I'd perhaps go in not asking questions, but go in with an ethnographic approach of just, you know, right, trying to experience what it is to be a tardigrade. To do, but I think if I went that small, they'd be really scary because those claws are huge. You often think, you know, I'd be quite terrified if I was the size of a tardigrade down there, because those claws could do a lot of damage, I reckon.
100%. Well, and you know, they look like bears, that's where they get the little nickname from, yep, right? So I can imagine it would absolutely be quite an imposing thing. Well, I think that's a really good answer. The idea of understanding what it's like to live another life is a difficult question to answer, right? But if we could shadow a tardigrade like an NQT mentor, that'd be a wonderful thing to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But Andrew, thank you so much for speaking to me today. It's been really wonderful to hear about all the life going on within the moss. And yeah, again, I'd encourage anyone to go on the website or just to take a moment to have a look at some moss and think very carefully about the things that existed in this.
But thank you so much for having me. I love talking about this, and I hope it inspires a lot of other people to get out there and just look at moss in a different way and all the organisms that live in there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you.
Grubbing in the Filth was written and produced by me, Tom Sharp, with music by Will Hatton. Thanks again to Andy Chandler-Gravitt. You can find Grubbing in the Filth on Twitter at GITF Podcast or Instagram at Grubbing in the Filth. You can also email grubbinginthefilth@gmail.com. Thank you.